So, Peter, as the host of NPR's news quiz show, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, you've managed to find a niche to bring humor into the news, which is generally pretty serious. Was that always your intention as a news writer, or was that accidental, maybe serendipitous?
Well, keep in mind that I was never a journalist, ever. In fact, I wasn't even a public radio person. I wasn't, well, frankly, anything that would have qualified me to do this job. I was just somebody who liked to make jokes, usually in private conversation. And one of the people to whom I used to make jokes, a theater director by the name of Barry Edelstein, recommended me to some people he knew at NPR, and I ended up on this brand new radio show, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, back in 1998 as a panelist. And then I became a host. So whatever you want to say about my career, intent had nothing to do with it. I am here as a result of random accident, which I'm grateful for, I should say. But I am a rebuke to all of those who believe you should envision what you want and go after and get it. My advice to everybody is just sit around and eventually something will fall in your lap. It worked for me.
It certainly did. And yet sometimes you do cover serious news. I'm specifically thinking of the bombings earlier this year at the Boston Marathon.
That was a very bizarre accident in many ways. What happened was I had run the Boston Marathon in April. I had run it as a guide for a blind runner named William Greer out of Austin, Texas. And just by strange coincidence, we crossed the line, the finish line, at around 4:04. The bomb went off at 4:09, 5 minutes later. We were 100 yards away beyond the finish line. So I heard it. I saw it. And because it was known that I had run the marathon and was just there, I got a call from NPR News, and they asked me to go on the air. So I was one of the first eyewitness reports from the scene. I should say two things about that. First of all, it really was an honor to be, for 2.5 minutes, an NPR reporter. I look up to my colleagues over there in the Sirius side. Although I contributed a little bit to the report, I probably knew less about what actually was going on than anybody in the world right then. Because while the rest of you were watching it on TV, I didn't have a TV or even a good connection to my phone to see things on Twitter. So I really had no idea of the carnage that had occurred just 100 yards away from me. I couldn't see it. They moved us away from it. So basically, I was like, something happened. I don't know what. That's all I had to say to the listeners of NPR. But people have talked to me. And they said it was nice to hear your calm voice at that moment and to know that I was okay, which I'm grateful for people saying. So, like I said, I was happy to play a part. But I think I'm better off over in the funny fart joke side of NPR's news coverage.
And, well, on that note, I'd love to hear a little more about Constitution USA. Was mixing a series on the Constitution with traveling across the country on a giant Stars and Stripes Harley Davidson hog sort of the ultimate example of American freedom? How did that come together?
It came together again through falling into my lap. I apparently have a capacious lap where good things fall. I don't know how this works for you, but it's a strategy for me. What happened was, to make it brief, Twin Cities Public TV, a major producer of documentaries for public TV, wanted to do something on the Constitution. They contacted a film company in New York called Insignia Films, who has done a lot of stuff for PBS, and they in turn contacted me. The idea was that they didn't want it to be a typical PBS documentary, which we can say, has a stentorian narrator who provides objective reality while the camera pans across landscapes and you interview experts. They wanted it to be more, well, for lack of a better word, human. They wanted to have somebody on screen bringing the viewer through this journey. And it became quite literally a journey with the addition of the motorcycle. And they thought that I would be a good person to do that. And I was all for it. Because as you say, or suggested, it is actually a fun thing to do when your day job is being funny to be serious every now and then. And I was able to bring my, I won't say patented approach, but my approach of mixing the serious and the funny and current events and fart jokes to, this pretty important civic issue, which I'm, for one, am pretty interested in. So instead of an expert telling you, the viewer, this is what is true, you had somebody who really doesn't know that much more than, the people watching saying, hey, I don't know, let's go find out. And that provided, I think, a nice framework for the documentary.
Yes. I was happy to see that the the photo from that tour that got the most press, it seems like, was the picture of you at the Hoover Dam on the Arizona-Nevada border. And that's in our neck of the woods.
It is.
You been here before?
I had been to Las Vegas many times before, but because I'm a big fan of hedonism and gambling, I did not take the time to go out to the Hoover Dam. And I did, and it was really fun, and I got to ride my motorcycle across it. And we ended up talking there. This was really fun. We had gone out to the Hoover Dam, as many people do, to use it as a very vivid and obviously spectacularly beautiful example of what the federal government can do in our system, right? The notion being that if it had just been up to the states, be it Nevada or Arizona or any of the states out there, they couldn't have done it. There's not enough money. There's not enough, you know, legal control over the water. It had to be a federal project. And that's why we have a federal government, to do the big things that benefits everyone. And there it is, a big symbol of that. And what was really fun was that almost by random chance, we talked to a ranger there, a guy who did guided tours of the dam, who was incredibly well-versed on that issue and can talk to us about the history of the dam and the way the federal government got together and made it happen. And what was interesting about this guy, who's in the documentary, is he, like a lot of people who live in that region, is politically a libertarian. He believes in individual freedom. He wants minimal government. That's why he lives in Arizona. But at the same time, he believed that without the federal government, you wouldn't have the Hoover Dam. And without the Hoover Dam, you wouldn't have modern Arizona, Nevada, New Mexico, even Southern California, because that project made these states possible. So right there, you capture the irony that in order to live free in an independent state that governs its people as it wants, like Arizona or Nevada do, you have to have the federal government in to make this all possible. Right there, it's the conundrum and the glory of the American system. And also, it's a pretty dam.
Peter, I think our listeners would really enjoy knowing how Wait Wait comes together. How much of it's scripted? How much of it's off the cuff? Is there any chance you can give away some production secrets?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's not a secret. What we do is, we do a lot of what I think the shows that people might enjoy, like, say, Jon Stewart's show or Stephen Colbert's show do, which is that we have a staff of people who are very smart and very bright. I'm excluding myself. I'm lucky enough to work with them. And we spend all week reading a lot of news stories, writing jokes about these news stories, trying to argue with each other, you know, like, I think this is funny. Well, I think that's funny. Well, this isn't funny. Or sometimes it's like, I'll take a current example, this ongoing crisis in Syria. And we feel like we have to talk about it. It's a big news story. But obviously, there are many aspects of that story that are extremely tragic. And so that becomes a problem. It's like, well, how can we talk about this? What's funny about the story? And how can we talk about it in a way that doesn't touch on the really tragic? You know, how do you, there's dead children in the middle of the story, but are there funny aspects? Yeah, well, you can talk about the political predicament and the personalities involved. And so we sort through all those issues. Sometimes it's difficult. Sometimes we know just what we're going to do at the very beginning of the week. Sometimes we make up our mind right before we tape at 7:30 on Thursdays. But what makes our show, I think, unique is that we then take those prepared scripts and questions and answers and jokes that we've worked very hard on and written and rewritten, and we sort of throw them at our panel and at Carl Castle and at our callers and at our Not My Job guest. And then we see what happens. The panel is entirely improvisatory, right? So everything you hear them say, pretty much, is not planned. And what it tends to happen is that our show, as edited and presented to the 4 million listeners, tends to really emphasize that improvisatory aspect of the show, which I think is our brand, you know? That's what we do better than, say, Stewart or Colbert. That's where I think where we stand out. Because what you're hearing from us is it's genuine, it's happening in the moment, it's not written jokes as good as they are. It's stuff that we didn't know was going to happen. And there's a spontaneity to our show that I think people really appreciate. Certainly I do. When I think of my favorite moments in the show, it's very rarely things that I or my colleagues wrote. It's stuff that, say, Paula Poundstone or Adam Felber or Roy Blunt or any of our people came up with in the moment. And that's what makes it fun.
You mentioned one of, you know, your favorite moments in the show. Is there something specific that comes to mind?
Oh, there are all kinds of things. Probably, I mean, I'm trying to think of a couple examples. I mean, to give you this idea of improvisation, some years ago we were doing a show in Seattle, and we did a show in honor of them about Bill Gates. And we mentioned Clippy, the animated paperclip that used to pop up on your screen when you use Microsoft Word,
right,
or something, and how everybody hated it. And I said the phrase, Clippy must die. And that led to a completely unscripted, like, 5-minute riff on the gangland execution of Clippy. And it really was so funny and could not have been written, but it just played out with Paul Provenza and myself and Adam Felber and Paula Poundstone. And I just remember, I think it was Adam's joke. It was like we had envisioned being, you know, Clippy being put in this car and brought out to the woods. And Clippy says, "Is that a business grave or a personal grave you're digging? Can I help?" And I was weeping on stage. I was laughing so hard. And there are many moments like that. A lot of these moments have to do with Paula Poundstone, who's incredibly vivid and improvisational. But all of our panelists are. That's why we have them around.
Well, Peter, I surveyed our listeners about what questions they would ask you if they could. And the number one question, not surprisingly, was when is Wait Wait coming to Flagstaff?
I would love to come to Flagstaff. First of all, you should know that I have never been to Flagstaff before. This is my first visit. I've been to Arizona. I've been to Phoenix many times, Tucson many times. Never been up to your neck of the woods. So I'm very excited about that because I've heard it's the most beautiful part of Arizona. And the answer to the answer to your question really is I don't know. We'd love to come. Maybe a lot of times what happen is, and you don't know, I'll go out to some place. This happened in Lincoln, Nebraska. I'll go out, I'll do a thing myself, and I'll come back and I'll say, "Hey guys, there's great people out there and wherever. We should take the show." So it could happen. So I think that we can hope to get out to Flagstaff, the nice part of Arizona, soon.
Well, another one of the questions our listeners were interested in knowing is, what was the worst interview you've ever conducted? And I assume they mean worst as in worst guest, not worst as in your own worst.
Oh, that's an easy question to answer. And I'm really glad that I can answer this question so quickly and easily and don't have to think about it. The answer is Gene Simmons.
Of Kiss.
Gene Simmons was on our show. This was many years ago. This was before we did the show in front of a live audience, which I'm grateful for because it would have been even worse if there had been more people listening. Many people who are really hardcore public radio fans remember his infamous interview with Terry Gross. And that was around 2002, I'm guessing here. It was the early 2000s. He had published a memoir. He was on a book tour. He appeared on our show. He appeared on Terry Gross's show. Now, the difference between what happened with us and Terry Gross is that he behaved the same way, i.e. incredibly obnoxiously and just saying the most horribly insulting, vile, and sexist things. But in our show, we cut it all out. We left it all on the cutting room floor. So if you were to go back and listen to me, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, interviewing Gene Simmons, you would hear almost nothing. It's like, "Hello, Gene Simmons, you were in Kiss. Great, play our game. Thank you. Go away." It was like 6 minutes because we cut out all the miserable misogyny and general obnoxiousness that he provided us with. Terry broadcast it. And it is truly amazing how incredibly awful that human being is. And I wonder, I don't know for a fact if he is in fact really that awful. I'm guessing he is. I've heard stories. Certainly, he is one of the few people who believes that his brand is improved by behaving like a complete jerk in public. And I wish him well with that career. But the great thing is that he was so awful, so just horrendous in every way, that he sucked up all our bad guest karma in one horrible 20-minute conversation. And it's as if, because of that, since then, we've almost had a great time with almost everybody.
Do you suppose he's aware of your feelings about this?
I think he would take pride in his interview with Terry. And I encourage people to go back and listen to it if they can. He doesn't like people to broadcast things. He's obsessive about his rights. But if you can hear it, he actually insults me during his interview with Terry. Because he was saying these vicious things about NPR. "Oh, NPR is boring. NPR is dull." And Terry, who does not stand for this treatment, said to him, "Oh, come on, you've never even listened to NPR." And he, of course, the answer is he hasn't. He was just going on about it. But he pauses and he says, "Oh, I was on it." And then he describes this really obnoxious or boring interviewer who interviewed him. He refers to that person as the DJ, and he makes fun of this DJ. That's me. So in his interview with Terry, he actually imitates me in an unflattering way. So given the fact that he said those mean things, he didn't remember my name, of course, but in addition to, I think he would appreciate the fact that I hate and loathe him as much as he would hate and loathe me.
Well, I was not expecting it to be Gene Simmons.
Yeah, I know, out of all the people, right?
Peter, the last question I'd like to run by you from our listeners is, when Carl Castle leaves the outgoing message on a winning contestant's answering machine, does he have to say whatever they come up with, or is there some kind of standard script for him?
Oh, no. He does custom messages. He will say almost whatever anybody wants. I say almost because the things that he won't do a commercial endorsement. So if you're an Avon lady, he won't say, "Buy Avon products." He won't do that. And the other thing he won't do is profanity, because he's a gentleman. But he, the great thing about Carl, and I've worked with him for 15 years, so I know this better than anybody, he'll do anything. You throw something at Carl, you say, Carl, we need you to bark like a dog, and he'll bark like a dog. You know, it's like, it's he loves it. He is like a cured Virginia ham. He will do anything you ask. There are some people who, in my view, make a terrible mistake of not taking advantage of this and writing a message like, hello, Bob and Jean can't come to the phone right now. Please leave a message. And you're like, what? You had this brilliant instrument and that's all you played with it? But, you know, it's their choice.
Peter Sagal, thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure. Fun to talk to you, and I look forward to seeing you guys in Flagstaff.
From NPR and Chicago Public Radio, this is a great way to tell me the NPR News Riz.
Professor.